Illinois faces some big challenges. Today, you're about to hear a truly honest analysis of the problems we face. Equally important, you'll also hear an in-depth discussion of some practical solutions. This is your radio source for stories, the insight, and the answers you won't hear anywhere else. Not on the media, and not coming from Springfield. You're listening to Illinois Rising, presented by the Illinois Opportunity Project. Now, here's your host, AM 560's Dan Proft.
Welcome to another edition of Illinois Rising. I'm Dan Proft, co-host of Chicago's Morning Answer, weekdays 5 to 9 a.m. on AM 560 with Amy Jacobson. And joining me is Ted Dabrowski, who is the president of Wirepoints.com, a public policy outlet that produces original work to assess all of the challenges facing the land of Lincoln and the city of Chicago within it. And the big challenge profile this week became an international story. Was the violence over Lollapalooza weekend, 12 dead, 74 shot. The culture of violence, I don't know if there's a way to put a finer point on it than the story CBS did profiling one of those killed. His name, Earl Young, murdered by a neighbor over puppy pee.
Young was murdered Friday, one of 12 killed over the violent weekend. Payne says it all stemmed from Young's two puppies on the porch of his South Shore home.
And the puppies were peeing on the porch. And the pee ran down the porch into the neighbors.
Police say Young and the neighbor below exchanged words. Then Young was shot and killed. He was 30.
How petty are we now that we're living in a world that you could lose your life over puppy pee?
How petty indeed. Obviously, most of this is gang and drug-related crime, but not all of it. It's a bigger cultural problem. And oh, by the way, as much as people have focused attention on this and it generated the pro forma pressers from Tiny Dancer and Eddie Johnson and the deployment of more police on the south and west sides of the city and the rehashing of all this kind of heal neighborhoods, heal the community, stop the flow of guns from Indiana, pablum that you get from the same old men and women that run the city and form its power structure. I went back and looked at some of the numbers for this year alone, and this is down from 2017. This year alone, we've averaged 1.6 murders per day in Chicago and about 8.4 shootings per day. So what you saw last weekend was basically the average carnage we get on a weekly basis. So when Rahm said this week that this isn't Chicago, no, it is Chicago. It's the Chicago that we've begotten. I hate to break it to you. Heather McDonald in the City Journal had a good piece this week, Shooting Up Chicago. She's the author of bestseller War on Cops. And she recounted a couple conversations. She had federal prosecutor here and a Chicago police detective, 24 years on the job. The federal prosecutor told Heather McDonald, the city is lost. We've never had crimes like this downtown, people getting shoved and robbed at 3 p.m. It's just brazen. Police detective, 24 years on the job, said, the kids who are mobbing downtown are the same ones doing the carjackings. This generation of kids has grown up with no one daring to touch them. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by one of Heather McDonald's colleagues at City Journal. He is Rafael Mangual, the Deputy Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute, who had a piece on Chicago's violence as well in City Journal this week. Rafael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you try to address in your piece at City Journal why Chicago can't get a handle on the shootings we're discussing. Why do you think?
Well, I mean, to me, the biggest thing that jumps out is how many of these shootings and murders are being committed by repeat offenders. I mean, if you look through the data, it seems like every other shooting is committed by someone who has been in custody of the Chicago Police Department at some point in the recent past. And what that tells me is that, you know, the city's major failure here is not identifying the people who are causing trouble, but it's keeping them behind bars, which, you know, goes against the grain of the, you know, the current tone in the criminal justice reform movement, which is, you know, really pushing de-incarceration. But what we see in Chicago is that, you know, at least in some cases, sentencing and pretrial detainment practices are probably too lenient, not too harsh. And that's how you can explain the fact that you know, someone who's arrested with a submachine gun ends up back on the street, you know, a few days later to be arrested again.
Now, does that mean, Rafa, that the laws and rules in Illinois and Chicago are just way too lenient compared to what you've looked at versus New York and in Los Angeles? I mean, I find it striking that we can have more murders than Los Angeles and New York combined. You know, what's the problem with our brand of crime? Is it because we're just too lax on that, you know, keeping people in jail?
I mean, that's definitely a big part of it from what I can see. I mean, New York has among the longest prison stay lengths, you know, than any state in the country. And I think that helped push its crime down. And, you know, the studies that were done, you know, about the sort of increase in the rate of incarceration during the 90s show that, you know, the increased rate of incarceration had a significant role in the overall decrease of violent crime around the country. And, you know, Chicago just doesn't seem to be doing that job, and people are getting out way too quickly. I mean, you know, occasionally the Chicago Police Department will put up a Facebook post sort of promoting, you know, one of the arrests that it makes. You know, and it'll show some pictures of the drugs and guns they recovered. And so back in April, I found one of these Facebook posts and they, you know, posted a picture of a submachine gun, some other firearms, a bunch of drugs and money that they recovered during the arrest of a guy named Kendrell McCurry. But 12 days after that post, McCurry was arrested again for dealing drugs. And then 2 weeks after that arrest, he was arrested on the same charge, which means that within a matter of days of that arrest for guns and drugs and illegal cash, this guy was back out on the street. And, you know, that's not an isolated incident. You know, you look through a lot of these major arrests, you find out that these guys have been arrested 5, 6, 20 times before. And, you know, that's just an unsustainable model. So, you know, I know that a lot of people at the national level have been talking about, you know, how too many people are being detained for too long pretrial and that sort of thing. But there's definitely a subset of the criminal population that we're being way too lenient on.
Well, and then those are where arrests are made and crimes are solved. And one of the other issues we have in Chicago, and I haven't looked at the comparative clearance rates in other big cities, but, you know, our clearance rate on capital cases, on murders, is consistently under 20%, sometimes under 10%. And so, obviously, not catching shooters is a message to that small segment of the population that are predators, that are violent criminals, that I can do whatever I want, I'm going to get away with it.
Exactly. And, you know, and part of that, you know, I think is just the size of the Chicago Police Department. You know, it strikes me as undersized. You know, I think they have between 12,000 and 13,000 officers.
Right.
But it's a pretty big geographical area that they have to cover. Unlike New York City, for example, the population isn't as dense in Chicago, especially in the high crime areas, which is also goes against the grain of something else that you hear. I mean, a lot of people, you know, crime is pretty concentrated around the country. And, you know, some of the things that people say in response to that is like, oh, well, it's concentrated in the places where the population is. But if you look at Chicago, the most densely populated parts of the city have some of the lowest crime rates. I mean, most of the population is concentrated, you know, from the loop up through the north side along the water. And the population density is much lower on the south and west sides, but the south and west side is where you're seeing most of the violence. And so when people are spread out, you need more cops. It seems to me that Chicago could use a significant number of police, and that I think helps explain at least part of why the clearance rate is potentially so low. And then the other part is just, you know, this no snitching ethic that prevails in these communities. I mean, people just aren't willing to talk to cops. I mean, I've talked to several police officers and departments in different cities around the country, and they say the same thing. You know, it's really hard to get cooperation from the community.
Well, and one of the interesting things this week too, Eddie Johnson, the police superintendent here, trying to, I think, do the bidding of the mayor and assuage the anxiety of much of the city's population, made the point that the violence, the shootings, pretty much contained in four of the city's 22 police districts. And that may very well be true, but The idea that Chicago police would be pursuing a policy of containment, George Kennan style, with the kind of carnage that is piling up in those four police districts is rather a jarring statement to hear from your lead police official.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, what that statistic tells you, though, is exactly how bad things are for those communities to whom the police department has an equal responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, he's right to say that the crime is uber concentrated in Chicago. I mean, I've done a study of this last year, and, you know, Chicago, when Chicago's crime really went through the roof and the president, you know, tweeted that he would send the feds in to stop the carnage, a lot of the sort of left-wing intelligentsia was pushing back against this notion that Chicago was a uniquely dangerous city. I mean, you had, you know, people tweeting that, oh, well, if you look at, you know, the citywide murder rate, Chicago's murder rate's not even in the top 10. You know, there are a number of cities that have lower, you know, higher homicide rates. You know, people would say smaller cities were had a higher murder rate per capita. And that's true. But that doesn't mean that the violence in Chicago is overblown, because Chicago's a pretty big city. And so what I did was I looked at where 75% of the murders happen, and it happens in a pretty definable, contiguous geographical area that contains about 40% of the population, and the murder rate in that area is double what the citywide murder rate is. And so, you know, these people use the citywide rate to kind of hide just how bad things are in the really bad neighborhoods, but the really bad neighborhoods are utterly insane. I mean, Chicago's citywide rate for murder in 2016 was something around 27 per 100,000. I mean, there are police districts and areas of the South and West Side where the murder rate exceeds 107 per 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's more than triple what the citywide rate is. I mean, it's really, really terrible what's happening in those neighborhoods. And, you know, the people in those communities deserve, you know, real policing that has been proven to work. The problem, though, is that so many people push back against those tactics when they're undertaken. So, you know, I kind of understand the frustration and the demoralization that some of these police departments are experiencing.
He is Rafael Mangual, Deputy Director of Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. You can check out his piece about Chicago's inability to get a handle on deadly shootings at the Manhattan-Institute.org website and City Journal as well. Rafael, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
I don't know what to do other than keep telling these stories, Ted, and see if people want to change out those who designed these systems. Alban Pegorski. Alban Pegorski retired at the age of 58 in 1998 from the Fox River Water Reclamation District. Serves about 180,000 residents out Kane County way. During his time, 40 years of work at this Water Reclamation District, paid $93,900 into his retirement. That was his contribution. Total, $93,900. His pension today is $211,000. He has received in his 20 years of retirement $3.5 million in pension payments for the $93,000 he put in. I don't even know what to say anymore. That I guess will penetrate the consciousness of the electorate in this state, particularly the suburbs, but just in general. These numbers are staggering.
No, they're staggering, and they're going to keep growing, right? And people are living longer and longer, especially these kind of people that have these kind of jobs. They're not risky jobs, right? So he's going to rake in more and more, and it's going to grow at 3% every year. So the staggering number will become super staggering.
And why? And then people are, what about my property taxes? Why are my property taxes so high? I mean, you know, nothing personal with Alban Pegorski, although somewhat personal. I mean, he's just benefiting from the system as designed. But because of Alban Pegorski is why your property taxes are so high. Or, for example, a North Cook News story this week, retiring Maine West High School principal Audrey Hogan, she contributed $358,000 toward her pension over her 33 years working for public schools and contributing to the teacher's retirement fund. It's projected that if she lives to, she's 54 years old. retiring at 54. Her final year salary, $162,000 as Maine West High School principal. If she lives to average life expectancy of a woman in her age cohort, she could collect as much as $7.137 million on $358,000 in contributions. She will get back everything that she put in by year three. She will make more by the age of 65, retired after nine years into retirement, than she did when she was working.
That's how it's designed. That's how it works.
It's designed to you make more in retirement than you did working.
And after 25 years, you're making two times more.
I don't think people understand this.
Well, but Dan, there's an important point I want to make. Maybe some people think that these are one-offs, like we're picking out one here, one there, and they're, you know. The truth is, and we've all looked at this, this is everywhere, you know, and it's not just the superintendents. It's not just the big dogs. The whole system works that way. It's designed for the smallest teacher to the highest paid teacher. It's systemic. It's everywhere in every district.
And then people can't figure out. We did a story in Kane County this week about what's happened, what the home sales are like the first 6 months of this year. Story after story of people losing six figures on sort of median priced homes when they go to sell. Because of the property taxes paid, the way the property taxes have devalued the home in terms of market value. It's just remarkable. For more on this topic, and particularly that area, Maine West High School in Des Plaines, we're pleased to be joined by Marilyn Smolinski, who is a Republican candidate running for state representative in that district against the incumbent Democrat Marty Moylan. Marilyn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So in Des Plaines and Park Ridge and parts of Elk Grove Village that are in your district, what are the conversations you have with future constituents about property taxes?
I mean, it's definitely the leading issue. I mean, it's a big reason why I'm running. We've got a system of government set up that benefits the people in charge, not the regular folks in our district. And when I meet with people throughout the community or when I'm going door to door, many of these residents have conveyed to me that they already have plans in place to move out of state because the property taxes are too high. And an example like this and the gentleman at the water reclamation system as well, I mean, these are just prime examples of the driving factors of why our property taxes are so high. And it's not just happening here, like Ted mentioned. It's a problem that we have across the state.
Why do you think, Marilyn, why do you think people put up with it? Is it, and I guess they don't. A lot of them that leave don't, right? And I think the more people that are leaving, the more we say that Illinois maybe don't care, but as the out-migration just picks up, right, we've lost over, on a net basis, 1.3 million people since 2000. Maybe they are leaving, but there's a lot of them who seem to be putting up with it. Are they, or do they not know, or what's your feel about why we haven't been able to change things?
I think we haven't been able to change things because we keep sending the same people down to Springfield. I mean, we've got the same people going down to Springfield who are underfunding these pensions, who have stole from these pension systems. And I want to go down to Springfield to bring back some transparency and fiscal responsibility.
And with respect to Maine West High School, I mean, that's a high school where less than half of the students, according to the Park exam, were rated as college ready, spends $19,000 per kid. Do you sense at all that people are starting to take a look at what we're spending on K through 12 education, even in the suburbs where there's an inclination that we're to provide blank checks to the local schools to protect their quality somehow? But do you think that maybe more people are starting to say, how much are we spending and what is it producing in terms of student preparedness?
Oh, yeah, I think they're definitely looking at that and pouring more money into our current system's not going to fix anything. I mean, Illinois teachers deserve to be, you know, enrolled in fair and efficient retirement systems. And we're not saying that they shouldn't be paid well, but we definitely need to have that accountability there. So we definitely need to be looking at it. And I know that people in my district are definitely talking about that.
What do you think in terms of, you know, same people down to Springfield pursuing the same policies? So what does paradigm shift? What does a change in policy look like on the issue of property taxes to you?
So I definitely think that we need to keep the promises that we've already made, right, in terms of pensions. We don't want to touch the benefits or retirements that are already earned, but we need a new deal that's fair to our taxpayers and that also provides retirees with financial security of knowing that their retirements will actually be there. So that means looking at 401k systems for new employees going forward. That means changes to COLA. That means, you know, I mean, Ted, the policy guy, he looks at the numbers all day long. Retirement at $54 at 54 years old and then having a multi-million-dollar pension isn't sustainable. So, you know, that's a good argument of why we need to start looking at changing the retirement age as well.
Now, Marilyn, there's some arguments that that many of us will make is that, yes, we need to change those things that you just mentioned, because that's really we need to do the right things going forward. Right. We can't keep doing the same stupid things.
Right.
Now, the question is, you know, how are we going to handle this massive debt that every year seems to grow and grow and grow? You know, is it only fixing the system going forward that's going to do it? Or are we going to have to dramatically change things so we have money for bringing those tax rates down and for making sure that money gets into the right places that oftentimes it's all being sucked into pensions? You know, how do we fix our debt problem? How do we get the taxes down, basically, is maybe the question.
Right. I mean, we need to look at consolidation across the state. I believe that it's 20% of our school districts have their own school boards. You know, we just need to look at things like that in terms of how are we duplicating services and how can we combine those services and to bring those costs down.
All right. She is Marilyn Smilinski. She's a Republican candidate for state representative running against Marty Moylan in the 55th District, which is Park Ridge, Des Plaines, part of Elk Grove Village. Marilyn, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Ted, I just want to pick up one point on the COLA. What's your impression of just eliminating the 3% COLA, indexing pension benefits to actual inflation, so it's not an annuity, which is now? How much could that bend the cost curve? How much could that simple reform start to bring us back from the abyss?
Going forward or?
Going forward.
Well, I think it probably have, you know, I looked at freezing the whole COLA until we get our crisis under control. And that was already 6 years ago when I looked at that. And, it, you know, freezing that COLA and saying we're not paying a cost of living adjustment till the pensions are survivable again. And we looked and that was about a third of the underfunded amount. So we're talking about a $30 billion impact, $30 to $40 billion probably. And
that seems like a pretty persuasive reform. That seems like a reform that people say, let's see, you're getting this benefit level, you're making more than you earned at a date certain. Obviously, these are defined benefit plans, so they're guaranteed regardless of market return. And so to give back that 3% COLA in a low inflation environment the last 20 years, that seems like something perhaps we could sell the public.
Well, I think so, and you could even be more fair than that. You know, you could say for pensions greater than, pick a number, 70,000,
yeah,
you freeze the COLAs. Those people who have pensions of 20,000 and 25,000, keep the COLAs.
Yeah.
Right? So those people who are going to be struggling a little bit more, defend them. But, you know, these guys that you mentioned earlier who got $200,000 pensions, why do they get COLAs?
Ted, dovetailing on our discussion of pensions, property taxes, not even a newly minted Hall of Famer can tackle Illinois property taxes. Brian Urlacher, inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame last weekend, gave a great speech, trying to sell his spread in Mettawa in Lake County. He spends most of his time in Arizona now. He bought his mansion, 11,000 square foot, 7-bedroom, 5-bath, 2 pole barns, 2-story playhouse. Bought it in 2004 for $2.3 million, which is about $3.08 million in 2018 dollars. The home is listed for sale presently $2.69 million. So that's about 13% less than he paid for it in real dollars. Down from $3 million when he listed it last May. His tax bill, 2017, is up... is at $50,000. It's up 64% since he bought it in 2004. So property tax bill has increased in real dollars 64% during the 14 years he's owned it. The value of the property has decreased 13% in real dollars since he's owned it. and even, and this is on the lower end. I mean, you're talking about high-end property. This is about 1.8%, the property tax bill as a percentage of home value at the ask price he has. And like most places, like places like Grays Lake, for you've got a $250,000 home, and it's more like 4% and 5% of home value. So Erlacher's relatively better situated, but obviously that price point is pretty rarefied air. And it just speaks to this larger problem of people's home value being decimated by property taxes, which are largely used to fund what?
Pensions.
And yeah. So we looked at McHenry County this week as in a continuing series of regional reports. And I mean, the stories are Trader Jamie Charles paid $300,000 in 1993 for a 5,000 square foot, five bedroom restored log cabin in Bull Valley in McHenry County, 3 acres. So 25 years later, it's $523,000 in 2018 dollars. He sold it on May 31st of this year for $350,000, effectively $227,000 less than when he paid. And over the time he owned the property, those 25 years, he paid another $300,000 in property taxes. His property tax bill when he sold, $17,293, effectively 4.9% of home value. On and on and on. You look at community after community. As we looked at home sales data for the first 6 months of this year in McHenry County, community by community, and you see people getting hammered. Even year over year, the housing recovery, not here, not in Illinois.
Not yet, no.
Bull Valley, year over year, 2017 to 2018, down 1.31% sale median sale price. Cary, down 2.5%. Algonquin, down 3.5%. Huntley down 5.5%. Richmond down 10%.
Well, Dan, people are getting scared now because they're saying, hey, if I don't get out of here now, it's bad now, and it's only going to get worse. So if I don't get out of here now, I'm in trouble. You know, I did the story recently of a mayor from Lakewood who looked at his tax bill. It was $16,000, almost $16,000 a year. He went down to Alabama, found a 10-acre nice spot down in Alabama, $2,000 a year. And he did the math. He did the math, the family math that everybody's doing in their kitchens or their living rooms, and said, wait a minute, if I save, you know, 13,000 something, whatever the number was, a year for the next 20 years, you know, I'm talking about, you know, 600 grand, a million, whatever it is. It's a lot of money. And that's the math that most families will do. And it's an easy one. It's a slam dunk when you start to realize how low they are.
Well, and speak to the property taxation, you know, where your property tax dollars are going, whether they're going to fund, you said pensions, and that's right. But I just don't think people have a sense of this. My property taxes, but it's to pay for these great schools. I mean, I get it, paying for a pension benefit, salary and pensions, which is the majority of the expense of school districts, is part of having good schools, having good personnel. But I don't think people understand the scale, just as we were talking about with some of these pensions in the previous segment.
Well, that's one. One is the, you know, the average. And again, I think there's a slide of, we have to be careful between some of the small cities downstate who really don't have the high salaries and the high pensions, to be fair to them. But on average, the average pension for a teacher who retires in their 50s, right, the average pension in Illinois for a career worker will be about $2.3 million. And that's very unaffordable to the people who live here. The average ordinary resident can't afford to pay those pensions. And that's what's adding up. And then you add all the districts and all the administrators, and that number's ballooned. And they, of course, make much more than that. So when you add all that monstrosity up, you end up with these 3% and 4% tax rates in places like McHenry County.
And this is why Brian Urlacher is choosing to spend his retirement in Chandler, Arizona, not Mettawa, Illinois. Ted, I remember back in 2003, Rob Blagojevich had a great idea. Let's borrow $10 billion. So we can start to pay down those unfunded pension liabilities. And he sold some big government Republicans that are still around running units of government on the idea. He wouldn't have passed it in the Illinois Senate without the support of Kirk Dillard, who's now the chairman of the RTA. He wouldn't have passed in the Senate without Dan Cronin, who's now the DuPage County Board Chairman. Ah, yeah, they never go away here. All good government Republicans, right? $10 billion borrowing deal to address the $43 billion in unfunded pension liabilities. And 15 years later, after piling on some more debt for us to finance, because, you know, that's who finances it, not the bond fairy, taxpayers do. Now the unfunded pension liability of the state is what, $130 billion?
Yep.
So we're taxing and spending and borrowing and taxing and spending and borrowing. And it's going so well that Tiny Dancer has introduced a new plan to do what? Rod Blagojevich Redux, $10 billion borrowing to deal with the city's unfunded pension liability. Good idea?
It's a horrible idea in every respect. And it's what's amazing about it is that this is the kind of thing that those guys are so good at spinning. Rahm and his advisors will make it sound like they're going to, you know, fund the pension plan, make it all better, remove the pension crisis. And, you know, little does he ignore, or he ignores the fact that you're just borrowing $10 billion from over here, right? And we create a new debt so that we can pay off the other one. It doesn't change the amount of debt we have. And there's a lot of things that are much more pernicious about this deal.
Well, but what he knows is that he's on the clock with the Chicago police and fire pensions that are woefully underfunded, that I've mentioned many times.
They're bankrupt.
Yeah, they're bankrupt. Right.
I mean,
Chicago police, if you look at their own filings with the Department of Insurance, they will be unable to pay out current beneficiaries in under 3 years by the end of 2021. And everybody likes to deny that, or it's not that bad, or they make sort of oblique wave offs like Tiny Dancer does, like FOP wants to do. But that's the math. And the math is inexorable, and the math doesn't care what your political affiliation is. And Tiny Dancer, with this borrowing scheme, is conceding the point.
Well, you know, what he would do is he would get to say, look, I fixed pensions. They go from 25% funded to 50% funded. Look what I did. I've removed the pension crisis off the problem. And what he would do is, on this borrowing, he would push back the repayment as far as possible. So it's not his problem, but somebody far in the future. And that's exactly what that Blago bond did. It's a 30-year bond deal. We're still paying off that bond. We've hardly paid off any of the debt yet.
Wait, so yeah, the details on that.
Yeah, so it was a 30-year bond borrowing. And, you know, as of now, I think we've paid off about one-tenth of it. So we still have, after 15 years of that bond being outstanding, we still owe nine-tenths of the debt. So, and, you know, that's plus interest. So we're just going to be paying off this bond forever.
So we borrowed $10 billion in 2003, and we owe $13.6 billion at present?
A principal and interest, correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's 15 years later.
15 years later.
I mean, this is what the state does, right? We're still financing groceries we bought in 1994. It's just everything's on the credit card and you pay the monthly minimum.
Exactly. Now let's talk about what's really, really bad about this deal. To make it happen, Rahm is, you know, my partner Mark Glennon likes to say he's willing to sell off the body parts of Illinois, of Chicago. He's willing to sell future.
Sell the parking meters again?
Exactly. In this case, we're going to sell future sales tax receipts.
Right.
And we're going to give them away. We're going to sell them off to an entity. And in the case of bankruptcy, that stuff's gone. So we're going to prioritize the bondholders over the citizens if real crisis comes. Just totally unfair, totally wrong.
And I mean, but there's no other way to find, there's no other way to borrow.
Well, that's the thing. We got to sell body parts in order to borrow.
So, I mean, we're literally selling our, you know, kind of to analogize it to the individual, you're selling your blood to keep the lights on.
Exactly. And what's wrong with that is that, you know, it would happen with the Skyway, it happened with the parking meters, and now it's happening here, but now they're calling it this securitization, which nobody really knows what it means, but you're taking these future sales tax revenues that should be spent on the city, maybe to help fight crime or schools, and we're giving it away.
And so...
And who knows how we'll spend it, right?
Well, right, of course, right. I mean, this is what we've been doing for generations, both parties, Democrats at the city level, Democrats and Republicans at the state level, And this is because there is no appetite or courage to reform any of these systems to change the way they operate. We're not going to do anything with respect to pension benefit levels. We're not going to do anything with respect to salaries and benefits and the expanse and expense of city government either.
Yeah, I mean, what if he said, look, we'll issue $10 billion, but only if we change the system going forward? Now that might be a little bit more, you know, palatable. But just to borrow to pay off one debt with a different credit card, that's a sin.
Remember when Tiny Dancer came back from D.C. and he was the tough guy who was going to make all the hard decisions?
Well, you know, what was
7 years in? How's that looking?
Well, in 2011, he came out and said, "I want 401ks for workers." Right? He said, "We got to do something about these colas."
Yeah,
he sounded pretty good.
Uh huh.
And that's all gone. Gone.
Yeah. Another bill of goods sold gleefully and accepted gleefully by not Mettawa, Illinois. As we continue to go around the infield of bad units of government in Chicago and Illinois, we'd be remiss if we didn't tackle the Chicago public school system, Abuse Inc. We'll talk about the abuse culture today. Let's talk about the abuse of taxpayers. CPS, huge bailout last year. $17 billion pension bailout is really what CPS got. And of course, for a unit of government that is junk rated and runs billion-dollar deficits annually, that instituted a new discipline so they don't have to do that again. They're going to tighten their belt. They're going to live within their means. They're going to internalize all of those cliches and make sure that CPS is spending its bailout dollars wisely. Is that what's happened, Ted?
Huh. Good one.
Yeah.
You know, I think so many people were skeptical, right?
I'm a riot.
So many people were skeptical about the bailout, and for good reasons, right? And so, you know, just recently they came out with this plan. And again, like you said, you'd expect some kind of, you know, humility. And instead they said, no, we're going to spend $1 billion more. We're going to hire 13% more school administrators, ignoring the fact that the school continues to shrink, ignoring the fact that, you know, we did a piece on all these school buildings, 17 school buildings that are dramatically, you know, well, they're empty. Right, they need to be shut down. They're going to defend those schools. They're going to just do even more of what they were doing, and all that will continue to keep that that mess, that bankruptcy process in order.
And the overall increase in spend year over year is, in terms of projecting to 2019 fiscal year, is 20%,
almost 20%, 18%, which is phenomenal. Could you imagine every school district around Illinois would, yeah. Of course, they all want more money. They would love to have 20% more. But here we go. We bail them out to try to fix their problems. And what they do is they just keep spending more. And again, they're going to build new schools as if that's the priority for a place like that.
So enrollment's declining. New schools are being built. Old schools are not being shuttered. And spending is increasing. Currently, what are the numbers? A Chicago Public School teacher retiring today who's maxed out will have put about $140,000 in, which is only really about a third theirs because CPS has been picking up two-thirds of the tab. That's for right. The last 30 years. So really more like, you know, $45,000, but let's just call it $140,000. $140,000 in, and they'll get guaranteed $2.1 million back.
That's right, about $70,000 starting a year, and then, of course, growing after that. The numbers just don't work.
And in the wake of the violence last weekend, we hear a lot about investing in our schools. Schools have to be better. We have to make sure that schools in the West and South Side are as good as the schools in Lincoln Park and the North Side. Are we underspending on the South and West Sides of Chicago? Is there a lack of investment in those communities with respect to CPS? Because that seems to be what a lot of the politicians have indicated.
Yeah, that's what the politicians indicate. But when we looked at these 17 schools that used to be, you know, pretty big schools, a decade ago, people have fled.
They're gone.
And what's interesting, they didn't leave the city. So the Tribune tracked a lot of these people. They just went to other schools. They implemented school choice on their own. So you've got this funny dynamic where, you know, CPS hates school choice, and yet these kids are leaving these failing schools and just trying to find any other school they can. So the question is, if you just opened it up better, perhaps a lot of this problem would be solved.
And
people would migrate to the schools that are best for them.
Well, right. And then perhaps those tax credit scholarships coming online will help facilitate that and increase its pace. But the other thing with some of the schools that you looked at, so what they're doing, though, even though they've got a fraction of the population, they're still pretending in terms of personnel and staffing, they're still pretending like it's the same student population they had a decade ago, even though it's a fraction of it now.
Well, it certainly costs a lot to run a whole school, right? When a lot of these schools are at 13 to 20% capacity, right? So these are big schools that are virtually empty, and they're keeping them going. And, you know, imagine the economies you could have by putting those kids in a different school and taking those resources by shutting those schools down and leveraging them somewhere else. That's being ignored.